Hawaii's Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. Yesterday was Memorial Day, and so today I would like to dedicate this program to one of America's greatest heroes, Colonel Leo Thorsness, an F-105 pilot who received the Medal of Honor and was a POW for over 6 years. My first guest today is Chuck Beiler, the author of Tempered Steel, a story about another F-105 pilot, James Kassler. Chuck, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Great. Thanks for joining me today.
Yesterday
was Memorial Day, and my thoughts were with my own father, Eldrick Hendrickson, who won a silver medal in World War II, and about all the F-105 pilots who have come to mean so much to me. As you know, I am developing a mini-series called Forgotten F-105 Warriors, and your book, Tempered Steel, is one of the best books I have ever read about F-105 pilots. Can you tell us about Colonel James Kassler?
Quick summary of his career. He flew in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and he remains singular as the only man ever to be awarded 3 Air Force Crosses. That's a decoration for combat valor, which is second only to the Medal of Honor.
And he became an ace, and what does an ace mean?
Yes, an ace under the American system is a pilot who has destroyed 5 enemy aircraft in aerial combat, you know, not shooting them up on the ground.
Uh-huh.
Kassler did that in Korea. In fact, he had a 6th and a one that was probable beyond that, but 5 makes you an ace. There were only 40 American aces in the Korean War.
Oh. And before that, how did he get into World War II? Because he was very young.
Yes. In fact, he could have avoided World War II entirely since he was born in 1926, but he intentionally graduated a semester early from high school, and he signed up. He originally should have been a pilot, a co-pilot, or navigator, but the pilot school was closed, and he would take too long to get through navigator school, so he volunteered to be a gunner, and he flew 7 combat missions over Japan as a B-29 tail gunner.
Wow. And what was his background? Where did he come from, and how did he get involved in flying? What was his...
Well, he was a typical Hoosier, born in South Bend, though he didn't live there except when he was a baby. His dad managed life insurance offices, and they moved around the country quite a bit. But his father had served in World War I. Both of his brothers also served in the military. So it was just the natural thing to do as a Hoosier. When the war comes along, you sign up. So he volunteered into World War II. He volunteered into Korea. He volunteered multiple times to get into Vietnam.
And for Vietnam, by then he was flying the F-105, the famed F-105.
Yes, exactly. He had gotten in on the ground floor of the 105 when it was in its early development, and in fact wrote some of the manuals for that aircraft when it was brand new.
And at that time when it was brand new, that's where it got its nickname, which is the Thud. And
yeah, some people said that derogatorily because they had a number of losses early on. After all, there was no 2-seat trainer back then. You had to transition just by getting in the airplane and flying it. And it was a beast. It remains in the record book as the largest single-seat, single-engine aircraft and jet fighter plane in the Air Force's history. Nothing that's bigger since has not had 2 pilots or 2 engines.
Well, it was real supersonic.
Yes. In fact, could exceed Mach 2 if you really wanted to, and it was the fastest thing under 10,000 feet in Southeast Asia.
Well, I've heard from a few pilots who, when a MiG was on their tail, believe that they hit Mach 2.
Oh, yeah. They went as fast as they possibly could go.
Well, it was such an incredibly dangerous time that few people remember that the air war at that time was unbelievable. There was so much protection against our airplanes. And tell us a little bit about the you pack six pack and the different areas that the pilots flew?
Well, one of the reasons they lost so many F-105 is that they were flying into North Vietnam, of course, and they were carrying 75% of the bomb load. They lost almost 400 F-105s. Now, not all those were combat damage. Some were operational losses, but still, it was a large loss rate, including pilots. Coincidentally, through marriage, I'm related to a backseater named Vince Scungio, whose remains had never been found. He flew in the Wild Weasels.
And the Wild Weasels were the F-105s that initially the F-105s had just one seat, and
correct.
Then they modified it to give it two seats, and the guy in the back was called an EWO.
EWO, electronic weapons officer, or sometimes just the bear. But his job was to track the SAM sites, and they would launch anti-radiation missiles and destroy the SAM sites. Very dangerous mission.
Because they always had to fly first. They went ahead of everybody else.
And you're down in the weeds a lot of the time, and you're shooting at the enemy who's also shooting back with the missiles. But the SAMs were responsible for quite a few losses, as well as 37 and 57 millimeter cannons. It was a huge array of weaponry, far more than our pilots faced in World War II.
Well, I know I've heard pilots tell me that the air was so full of flak that they really couldn't see where they were going. It was unbelievable. Tell me, when at that time the pilots had to make how many flights to finish their mission?
Like Korea, they had to do 100. When you look at World War II, it was 25 and then later 35.
Mm-hmm.
But a 100 mission was almost unattainable in most people's minds. In fact, the joke about F-105 pilots, that before the average F-105 pilot got to 100 missions, he had been shot down twice and recovered once. And, of course, that meant he became a POW.
And Colonel Kassler was on which flight when he was shot down?
He was on his 91st, but I would interject that he had also volunteered for another 100 missions at that time, and there were pitiably few guys who got through 200 missions.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that day? Of course, you met with him quite a few times to interview him.
Yes.
And
right.
What did he say about that day?
That day was horrendous. They were on a low-level mission, 200 feet off the deck, and his wingman was shot down. And in a valiant effort to cover his wingman, he too was shot down. He took several hits from 57 millimeter, took out his primary and his backup hydraulics, took out his engine. Well, now you don't have a flyable airplane. And he was rolling toward the ground because the control stick had locked over his right thigh. And here's where it gets really ugly. He had to eject, and when he did, it drove his right knee into the canopy rail, snapped the bone off above his knee, splintered it near the hip, rammed his thigh bone up into his gut.
Okay, that's...
That's a great way to start your...
Yeah, prison. No, exactly. It was horrendous. But he survived the fall, and he was captured.
Yes.
And then what happened then?
Well, he was a special asset to the North Vietnamese. It was all about propaganda and getting the American pilots to make statements against the war and against their country. He refused to do that, and so he was tortured extensively, as nearly all the POWs were.
Because he was already famous for having been an ace.
Oh, yeah, he was an ace from Korea. In fact, they had three of our Korean War aces captured in North Vietnam.
So he landed up at the Hanoi Hilton?
Yes.
And he was there for how long?
More than 6.5 years.
Wow. And when you met him, did he, what was his comments about it? What did he talk about? Did he talk about those years?
Yes, he did. I was able to get a hold of the original civilian transcripts when he was debriefed. I could not get a hold of the official military. But John Hubble wrote a big book for a Reader's Digest called simply POW, Prisoner of War. And Hubble very graciously handed me those unedited transcripts. And that became a launching point for dealing with that. Plus, Kassler was very generous with his time, and I've lost track of how many times I went from Pennsylvania out to Illinois to interview him.
Well, how
and
did...
Then when I,
How did you get involved in writing the book? Because you were...
I was an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
But, this is a highly unlikely story, and of course it has a strange twist in it. By 1984, the last F-105 mission was flown, and waxing nostalgic, I began looking for the survivors. And I found myself in an airbase museum down in Georgia, and coincidentally discovered this was where Robert L. Scott had begun his flying career. And as I was reading about him in a showcase, I heard two gentlemen behind me talking, and this realization swept over me. It's General Robert L. Scott. And sure enough, he said, "Yes, I am," when I asked the question, and then I had a conversation with him. On the heels of that was the summer of 86, John Frisbee wrote an article about James Kassler for the Valor page in Air Force Magazine, and I got to read the rest of his story, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the three Air Force crosses.
And
so I knew at that point, I wrote to him through Frisbee, and I got a personal reply back, which really surprised me. You know, as a lowly enlisted guy, you don't exactly hobnob with the officers. But I was able then to go the next summer out to his golf course and introduce myself, and he told me the story about his first supersonic dive in an F-86A, which was nearly disastrous, you know, in Korea. And I knew he had a story to tell, and I wanted to write it, but I had no credentials. So I went off and got myself a master's degree, self-published a novel about Vietnam, and went back to him, handed the book to him, and said, "Sir, I'd like to write your story." And he just looked at me with that deadpan of his, neither saying yes nor no. But because he didn't say no, I started the process.
Which took a lot of research, and I understand that you traveled a great deal to interview many people.
Yes. That first year, I retired finally from teaching in 99 because I realized I needed a lot more time than teaching was providing me to do the research and writing. I put 30,000 miles on my car that year, all over the country, to the various important people in Kassler's life, from Florida out to Arizona, out to Indiana, Illinois, Tennessee, you name it.
And, of course, one of the things that that I'm sure most of the pilots talked about were the very, very strange rules of engagement that they had to fly under.
Oh, certainly. Everybody complained about that, from Jack Broughton, who wrote Thud Ridge and Going Downtown and Rupert Red 2, and everybody you talked to complained about it because you weren't allowed to hit the enemy until he was literally shooting at you. You couldn't hit a SAM site while it was being constructed. It had to be up and running and tracking you and ready to fire before you could shoot back. Ridiculous constraints.
When you met with Colonel Kassler, of course, you met his family and his wife?
Yes. Martha was a real trooper. She was already pregnant when he signed up for Korea. That comes under the heading of what was he thinking. And they lost a pair of twins, one stillborn, the other shortly after birth, because they caught a bad flu when they were up in Maine before he was sent overseas. But she stuck with him. They were married for 65 years, so she is indeed a real trooper.
Now, tell me, when after he came back from the war, he was involved in business here?
Yes. Well, first of all, he flew again, despite the horrendous injury he had suffered. He left his one leg shorter than the other.
He flew the F-111.
By that time, the 105 was
gone.
Out of service. But he was a vice commander and could easily have made general if he could have just stuck around for another year. But he owned this golf course, and it was going under. And he decided that since he was so close to the end of his Air Force career, they won't let you fly or command forever, that he got out and he ran the golf course for many years. In fact, just maybe 3 or 4 years ago, sold it. And, of course, he passed away last year.
Tell me, when you were doing your interviews, who were some of the other pilots that you met?
Well, I spent a long afternoon with Robbie Reisner.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah, Korean War ace, terrific guy, real gentleman. And Hoyt S. Vandenberg Jr., son of the second chief of staff, was one of our squadron commanders at Pittsburg, and I got to spend 2.5 days, and he was very generous with his time. He and Kassler have been lifelong friends. Kassler was his gunnery instructor after Korea, and they both flew F-105s out of Pittsburg, but ironically, Vandenberg Jr. got switched over the F-4 Phantom for Vietnam, flown the F-105 all that time, and then he gets switched out. I crossed paths a bit with Admiral Stockdale through phone calls and letters and, you know, back and forth with the manuscript as he offered suggestions. And Bob White, the X-15 astronaut, who was actually my squadron commander at Pittsburgh. Now, you don't walk up to the squadron commander and have a conversation, but I certainly knew who he was. And I had some letter exchanges with him, too, when he was retired down in Florida. He, by the way, was the test pilot in the original fly-off between the F-105 and the F-107. And if you've never heard of a 107, that's why, because Bob White chose the F-105. And he would get an Air Force Cross for the Dumas Bridge Raid in Vietnam. So quite a distinguished career. You know, he came to Pittsburgh having all that X-15 experience, where he was the first man out of the atmosphere in a rocket plane, the first guy to fly 4, 5, and 6 times the speed of sound.
Well, I always think it's so sad that they didn't keep at least one F-105 intact. And now we have to go from museum to museum to find a little bit, you know.
Yep.
I still cannot understand the thinking behind not preserving at least a few of every type of airplane. It's particularly the F-105, which is such an amazing aircraft and was such a for the pilots. I know that they all found it so thrilling and exciting to fly it that they didn't leave one around, you know, for history. It's very strange.
They're around as museum pieces. None of them are flying, although the Collins Foundation is trying to get one back in the air. It requires an act of Congress, by the way, since every aircraft since the F-84 has been nuclear capable.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets keep very tight tabs on where our F-105s are, lest we return one to service, and our B-52s, you know, which the nuclear capable versions. They can go out and check them, make sure they're still sitting on the ground where they belong.
Yeah, well, I all of our F-105s are in no shape to take off, I'm afraid.
No,
it's terrible because they it's a beautiful aircraft, and the pilots who we lost so many pilots, and of course it's so sad when you look at the long list. Now tell us a little bit. I know that of course you know Leo Thorsness, and I dedicated this program to him today because he's very, very special.
Yes. There were only two F-105 pilots that received the Medal of Honor. And actually, his Medal of Honor plane served at Pittsburgh. You know, he wasn't there, but his plane was, and that, unfortunately, was lost after the war. Survived the war only to succumb to an accident on a gunnery range. But out of all those thousands of missions north, only two Medals of Honor, and currently, I understand, Leo is one of only three living Medal of Honor recipients in the Air Force.
Well, his story, just like Colonel Kassler's story, is amazing. Luckily, they did do a program on the History Channel about dogfights, and I believe both of them have their dogfight is recorded on that program.
Kassler's dogfight series, actually it's posted on the internet, you can look it up. But it was about the day he made ace in Korea. They make no mention of his book, of his three Air Force crosses, of his service in Vietnam, or the POW experience. So he remains a man who's not widely known. My whole purpose in doing this was to bring him out of obscurity so people would know who he is. We've sold over 7,000 books. It's still available. My publisher promises it will remain in print, and there's also an e-book version for those of you who prefer that.
Yes, it's on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon,
absolutely.
And it's called Tempered Steel, and it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it to everyone. It's inspiring. It's a story of an American hero, of what we can accomplish here in America when we set our heart to doing something, just like you did, you know, making a decision, because you were a bomb loader. Is that what you were?
I was a weapons loader.
Weapons loader. Yeah. And from that, and then eventually one day deciding to write a book and going out and doing everything necessary to get it done, that shows determination, and I just love that. And I want everybody, as you know, I'm working with the F-105 pilots to preserve their stories, and I collect their stories. And so anybody who has any F-105 stories or knows any F-105 pilots, they should go to my webpage, and it's radio-joyonpaper.com, and let me know, because I'm happy to talk to any family member of a F-105 pilot, or to anyone who's written a book about F-105 pilots. So, Chuck, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I know that people will enjoy your book, and I hope they'll go to the Amazon and get it. And at the same time, they should get Leo Thorsness's book, Surviving Hell, A POW's Journey. Both of these men suffered so much, and yet, don't you agree that one of the most wonderful things is that they came out still with so much spirit, with so much vigor for America and for life and for their families?
Exactly.
It's wonderful that you've done this, that you've preserved this, and I want to thank you for your service, and to thank all veterans for their service. And so God bless you, Chuck, and thank you so much for being on my program today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
I love my plane. It is my body, I am its brain. My Thunder Chief loves me, and I love her too. But I get the creeps with only one seat and one engine too. She's faster than...
This is WTAN 1340, Tampa Bay's Tan Talk Radio, coming to you from beautiful downtown Clearwater, Florida. We'll be right back after a few messages.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Did we get a song? Did we get a song? Do we have a turntable?
Hey, everybody, this is Andy Powell, guitarist, Wishbone Ash, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, but it's not a reel-to-reel, though, right?
It's Nostalgic Radio and Cars every Tuesday night from 7 until 8.
We're doing vinyl tonight.
And one of my favorite pinball machines was Aces and Kings. It was a Williams machine. 40 years later, I found that machine.
Don't wait 40 years to find out about Nostalgic Radio and Cars. It's on Tuesday night from 7 until 8.
Here on Tantalk.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Graduations are coming up. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china, you will find just what you're looking for. One that says, you care. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo, the Silver Queen is the place to go. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
The city of Dunedin introduces baseball done our way. Start with a morning on our pristine beaches. Next, off to downtown for some unique shopping. Then a bit of lunch at one of our many award-winning restaurants. And now, time for an afternoon game at Florida Auto Exchange Stadium. Finish the day off with a sunset cruise on the Gulf. A day in Dunedin. A day done our way. For more information, go to DunedinGov.com.
Some people don't believe in mermaids. Hope that's not you, because they exist at Wickiwatchee Springs State Park off US 19 and State Road 50, just north of Spring Hill. Since 1947, the magic of the mermaids have been entertaining visitors at the 538-acre Springs Park. Come and watch in the 400-seat submerged theater, The Little Mermaid Show at 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. daily. Wickiwatchee State Park offers mermaid shows, reptile shows, boat tours, and swimming in the pristine spring at Buccaneer Bay. Wickiwatchee State Park is a perfect backdrop for wedding receptions, birthday parties, picnics, meetings, retreats, family reunions, or just to relax on the white sandy beach. Step back in time when things were much simpler and enjoyable. Spend the day at an original theme park. Call 352-592-5656 or log on to wickiwatchee.com for upcoming events, hours, and ticket pricing. Wickiwatchee Springs State Park, where mermaids do exist.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guests, Trish and Ray Arredondo, who have joined me in the studio today. My guests have done what I have been urging all of you to do. Write a book. Preserve those memories. Write a book about your life, about your grandfather, or, as in the case of my guests, a book to honor your mother. Maria's Journey, a story about Ray's mother, does just that. Hi, Trish.
Hi.
Hi, Ray.
How you doing?
Okay. Ray, tell us about your book and about your mother.
Well, when I started to write this book, I did it because I never thanked my parents, told them I loved them enough while they were alive, and I wanted a way to honor my mom and my parents. And so when I retired, having no hobbies, I asked my wife if she would help in this endeavor. And so we wrote this book because I always thought my mother and my grandmother were just, I was always awed by these women who could multitask and, you know, how they did everything and were able to raise, my mom raised a family of 10 children. And I was just always awed by this, and I thought, I want to write a book about her. I want people to know about this and, you know, preserve something for the family and for future generations. And when we wrote this, it was never intended to be published. It was going to be archived, the local
in Indiana. So, Trish, you really swung into action on this.
Oh, I did, and it was a joy. It really was. It was an amazing journey for us as well, because both I and Ray's family learned so much through writing this. That was the amazing part.
So where did you start? How did you start?
Well, I had actually started, I was also an English teacher, English and history, and then I moved into women's health and education for women and kids. But I love to write and always have, and I wanted to write a book about my mother, which I did, a very small book that we rushed through, but it's mostly just factual, not the kind of novel that we put together here. And then when Ray asked me to do this, we did one similar, and then I realized there's so much more.
There's a big story, a full story.
It's a huge story. All people have a huge story, but most of them hesitant to do it because they don't know where to start. So we're trying to work with people on getting them moving on that. But that's how we actually got started. And in those days, I was not technically very astute, nor was Ray. So I wrote it by hand on a pink legal pad, pink, hundreds of them, and flip charts, where we'd have to figure out with all these kids and all these activities what was going on. So we had to see the dates, and I had to see them. I'm very visual, so I had to see them in front of me. And we struggled through like that. Now we learned to use the computer a little, and it helps.
So let's go back to the beginning. Tell us when did your mother come to America, and how did she come? What was the story behind that?
After the Mexican Revolution, was winding down, my parents came in the late 20s. My dad got a job in Texas in a railroad, and my mom had already had the first child. She was the only one of the siblings born in Mexico. And he sent for them, and they came to Texas. They worked there a while, and then he got a job up in Illinois, near Joliet, Blue Island, Illinois, with the railroad company. So he was more like a transfer then. And then once he got there, after a while, he heard that the steel mills paid better money, so he worked his way up to Indiana, up in bottom of Lake Michigan, and it's known for steel mills and oil refineries in that area. So he went looking for a job there, but at the time there were no local unions, and so the workers would show up at the gates of the steel mills and were picked by the foreman, handpicked as to who would get a job for the day. So my dad got involved into trying to form the first local union for steelworkers in East Chicago, Indiana, which later became the largest steelworker union in the country. And my oldest brother became president at one time. But that's how they worked their way to the Indiana. And then, of course, once they got into Indiana, then they had to go through all the adversities of World War, Depression, and then World War, and so many other problems that immigrants face as far as the biases and discrimination. And also, it was quite a thing growing up there. Of course, I came in at the latter part because I'm the 9 of 10 children.
You're the baby.
So the book is really capturing from the late 20s to the mid-50s, and I came in toward the end of that.
And one of the things he forgot to mention is on the cover of the book is a picture of his mother at the age of 14 with his grandmother, Rita. It was an arranged marriage. Neither Miguel nor Maria knew each other. And what I found so fascinating, because I love the character stuff, each mother-in-law had a specific reason they wanted these two to be together. And they were, I mean, she was just, Maria was, I'm a child, you know. But they married, he was 17 and she was 14. So it was an arranged marriage. It was amazing to me that because they obeyed their parents, they followed those, even though that was not their choice.
So those challenges that Maria faced in those early years in the 1920s, 30s, what?
Well, one of the first things was, of course, they came to this country being able to speak English, had no job, and had no money to speak of. So my dad, when he first came over, he came because a cousin of his, was told, come, I think I can get you a job. So he came, and he got a job at the railroad. And so once he started making money, they lived in a boxcar in Texas. And so that's the way they started. And my mom came up with my sister. And then she and other women would either cook or do laundry to make extra money for the people, the men that were working at the railroad. And so they worked their way through this whole process. But, you know, there was never anything that was really handed to them. My mom would go shopping, and she'd have people point things out to her as to what she would have to do, because she couldn't speak the language. She didn't know what to do. So she had to learn. She's just a very young girl. I mean, when she came, she was only 15 years old, or 16. And so she had no way of knowing how to get by. So people would basically take her and show her how to get through. And so she started learning little by little of how to make it in this country.
Well, one of the other things that was so interesting to me is that her older daughter, who was very instrumental, her name is Juanita, Jenny, we call her, helped her mother as almost a second mother, because she was born when she was 15. And they would speak English, but his father would not allow it at all at home, because he always wanted to go back to Mexico and raise mother. Absolutely never wanted to see it again. She had picked in the fields, had a terribly difficult life. And so the interaction between the father and the mother, Miguel and Maria, for me was very, very interesting. He looked at the big world picture and politics and the whole how to help the working man. She looked at every time you do this, you get fired from the mill with the union stuff. And I got, by the, you know, 10 kids eventually. So there was a wonderful kind of clash as well as a great love. And she really put up with an amazing, amazing amount of things. And we wrote it, warts and all. We debated. One of the things we debated about, and many people when they're writing, excuse me, we looked at like George Washington and the cherry tree. And then when I got real history, I thought, wait, that wasn't exactly the way it went. So we put all of the heartaches and the family skeletons in as well. And when we talk to people about writing their own book, we always say, if your family, if you think it's not dysfunctional, that's just because you haven't looked enough. And if you're going to do that and tell the true story, that helps other people to feel and understand and go through these trials and tribulations. And we have a book club at where we live, and the women always talk about this. And I said, if anybody tells you their family's not dysfunctional and they haven't had problems, they are either denying, if they're over 30, they're just lying, and they're so boring we don't want to read the book anyway. Yeah, if it's
exactly
really that way.
When you want to make it an interesting book as opposed to just a list of facts, you do have to tell the true story, and you have to make it come alive. And you know, I was reading some of the reviews, and people are just saying how you make the whole story come alive and involve so many layers of interest in the story, Maria's story, Miguel's story, and the whole American story of success and working hard, which is, you know, the key.
Yes, Trish did a terrific job of writing and making the story flow, connecting the dots, and making it interesting. And there's one chapter in there where she describes the steel mill, what it was like working in a steel mill with the smells and all. And we were presenting this at a group, and one of the ladies said, you know, when I read that, she said, I closed my eyes afterward, and she said, I could literally smell that place. I could see it in my mind. It was so well described. And Trish had never been to a steel mill. So that's how good of a writer
she is.
Well,
I was listening. I saw one later, but it's called Mill Rats, that particular chapter. And it was, for me, it was the concept the men would leave, and the men were very much in charge. That was a whole different era. And then they would slow their steps the closer they got to the gate. And then when they went in, they were the man's. They belonged to that factory. And it wasn't until they left in the evening that they took their, you know, their shoulders went back, and the closer they got to home, the more they felt like real men. Because in those days, what you did to get the job was to stand by the mill in the morning, and they just pick you. There were absolutely no bathroom breaks, no nothing, no benefits.
No job security at that time.
No job security. And particularly if you're trying to start a union. And his mother would look down from one of the many places that they moved and see him leading a march of, you know, people who were pro-union, and just know that the next day he wouldn't have a job.
Yeah, well, I know quite a bit about unions, too. My father was in the Teamsters Union, mm-hmm. And so we went through that whole period in during my childhood when there were union problems and there were strikes and there were times where, like, there's no money coming in because they're on strike, you know, and it wasn't in, like now when they go on strike, they have all these funds and things. In those days, when the guys went on strike, they didn't get any money, and they were really, there's no way they would have taken handouts.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And there's no way. I mean, we literally, we didn't starve, but I remember one time where we had like a month where I think all we ate was rice and a very strange thing, how we got this, I don't know, frozen strawberries. Huh. And for a month, because they must have been, you know, just like off the back of a truck or something, because for a month during a strike, that's all we ate was rice and frozen strawberries. Very strange. So I know what it felt like too.
And you make an interesting point, because this book is, the story is not unlike other immigrant families. I mean, we all came here. The parents came here looking for a better way of life, better life for their children. But you know, my mom always believed this country is the best country in the world because it affords everyone, no matter who or what nationality you are, it affords everyone an opportunity. What you do with that opportunity is up to you. But if you work hard, you're willing to make some sacrifices, you can succeed in this country.
Exactly.
And the other thing that both of his parents were very much for was discipline. And we used to laugh and tell his mother she'd be in jail now, because if one child did something, they all got punished. There was no messing around. And God help you if you got in trouble at school, because you go home and you get in the same, you know, you get the same, if not worse. So it was very fascinating to me to see how life has changed so radically from what we used to do. And my parents were not into corporal punishment at all, but we behaved, you know, and they also brought their money home. When they worked, his brother started four years old, I believe, his brother Jesse, the oldest, with paper route. And that was given to Mama. And she gave you back what she thought you needed.
Oh, I know it. I did the paper route thing too. Exactly. As I mentioned to you, I'm from Northern Michigan, and from a small town. And we did the same thing. We worked, and we gave, you know, to the family, and that was just the way thing we did, you know.
Well, family, faith, and there's a great deal of, it's not a preachy book by any means, but St. Jude was the saint of cases despaired of, and she was the family, he was the family saint. And the faith and the family and friends were amazingly important in her life. And the things that she did, how they came, there was something called repatriation, which I had never heard of until we started looking at this. And they promised everybody during the Depression, when they didn't need the Mexicans, they brought them up, but they promised them, during the Depression, we'll send you home, get you a job, and those of you who want to go home, we'll take you to your hometown and make sure everything's great, which, of course, materialized as far as putting them on, shuffling them down and dumping them at the border inside Mexico. And his mother resisted that like you wouldn't believe, and his father wanted to because he was a weaver and he thought he could go back now. And so they made it through that, and then there were some really hard times when she actually did go back to Mexico, and the mother-in-law, her mother-in-law, her name was Camilla. She was described by everybody who was interviewed, and that's how I got a lot of this, is interviewed all of his siblings. And 30 years prior, I had a colleague who came to me, and they were doing something called Pass the Culture, which back in the day was slideshow. And they wanted, we had a huge diverse population. They wanted us to represent the Mexican. I said, I'll have to ask Ray's mother. And she had them over for breakfast, and they did the interviews. So we had all this and 8 hours of tape. Dr. James Lane was the man who encouraged us to submit this. And so when we started writing it 30-some years later, all this was there. And I had all of that to draw on. And the women remembered everything, including what they wore to the World's Fair or whatever. And the men were very much more into the politics and the steel. And the.
Well, I can see you did so much research for this. And I know, well, of course, one of the beautiful things, tell me, what do you do with the money that you earn from this book? That's so.
Yes, what we did is we set up an educational fund. And, you know, we've been very fortunate in our lives, so we wanted to give back. And our way of giving back is what we do with the money. All the profits that we make from the books go into the fund, and we give out scholarships to people in college who are needy. It's the first requirement, and who are good students, and then the
No, they don't have to be good. They have to be C students.
Yeah.
We don't think everybody has to be a genius.
Yeah, but they have to
They have to work hard. They have to show that they'll probably give back to the community. And we let them, whomever we're doing the program with, and not just colleges, but high schools and any not-for-profit that has a needy We've done it for a woman who had seven kids, so it doesn't age is not a factor.
And we don't select the
no, they pick
students.
The person because we don't know them. Yeah. We travel all over the country, so.
And you also devote a good portion of your time to talking to groups about how to do this, yes. to do what you've done, how to sit down and get to work on it.
That's yes. right. And you could tell them how this came about.
Well, yeah. this came about. I told my mom I wanted to write a story about her before she passed away. And she just looked at me and kind of laughed and said, you know, I've been here all my life. I've never done anything. She said, what are you going to write about? There's nothing to write about. And if you ever did write a book, no one would ever pay anything to read a book about nothing.
And now you're in your second printing.
And I said, but Mom, I always thought, you know, what all you did, especially, like I said, I was always awed by the woman in my life. And I said, there is a lot to write about here. But I we encourage people when we give presentations is, you know, if you don't do it, and I always tell people, if you don't do it, no one else is going to do it, because I'm one of 10 siblings. And most of my siblings always wanted to write a book about our family, and no one ever did. And had I not done it, no one ever would. And what happens is you interview, as Tricia said, would tell them, interview the oldest people because they know a lot more than the young people.
And
they know the history.
Yeah, and even those who are not necessarily living in the present will remember the past, and they love to do it. We would do it with either notes or a little recorder, and they have so much to give and so much to tell, and they love doing it. So that's a wonderful way to start. And then, of course, getting the actual letters or records and so forth that you can find, photographs, gives you so much, tells so much. So we try to help people who are like us. They would come to us and say, I'd love to do this, but I wouldn't know where to start. So we're doing a little booklet thing, that kind of a works thing that goes with Maria's journey, which helps them to, even if they are technically challenged, as we certainly are, to be able to recognize what the steps are and, you know, how it is. And we warn them, because we have a friend, we have helped a lot of people do their books, and we have a very close friend in Wayne DiNardo and his wife Jean out in Oregon, who help us out there with the marketing for the book. And we said, we'll write your book. You know, we were just going to put together the genealogy. Well, it turned out to be a two-volume, 280-page, because all the kids wrote their stories about the family. And it was just an amazing bring people together and learn. And some of the fears that people have are taken care of when you actually get the real story. And then some other things that surprise you.
And tell us about your website. Where can people learn more, and and also about
The website is mariasjourney.com, and you can go on our website and our Facebook, and you can also go, if you want to purchase the book, onto amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. It's also on ebook and also in the Nook, and you also go to Indiana Historical Society, who also has it on their ebook, and you can purchase it there also.
They are our publishers, Indiana Society Press.
Indiana Historical Society Press. But our website has a lot about the scholarships we've given out, where we've presented the book.
If they want a program, they can fill out the information.
There's information for that and information about the scholarship fund. If you're interested in acquiring a scholarship for someone, how you can go about that.
And all the other places. There's pictures, which we're working on. We have somebody do this for us. In fact, our son-in-law started it, and we have somebody who helps us because we're so bad at it. But there are pictures of all the other programs that we have done and where they were and what they were for. And as Ray said, some are in Spanish, some are at retirement homes, many are in universities, book clubs, civic groups, anybody who really is interested.
And
we'd love to talk.
One thing we're working on is trying to get the book translated into Spanish, because many communities we've been to, the Spanish community people come up to me and say, well, you know, I'd like to read the book, but I don't read English. And so we're trying to get it done in Spanish, get it translated and published so that we can put it out into the Hispanic communities.
It's an inspiring book. It's also got some heartache, and it's got a lot of funny things.
But that's life.
That's life, and that's why we did it that way.
And that's what it's learning about people who survive these tragedies that keep you going and that make life interesting. So I think it's fantastic what you're doing. And I know there are many people who want to write a book, and if they contact you, I'm sure that you'd be happy to help them.
Absolutely.
And, if anybody has a group, I know that you would love to speak. You're living permanently now here in Florida, right?
We are half and half, but this is the first thing we've done in Florida that's media-oriented. We've done it all over the country, but this is the first time we've actually had time to sit down and get going here, so we're hoping this brings a lot of people.
Well, I'm so glad that you're here, and I will, you know, of course, put it on my Facebook page, and it's Patsy Gill at Facebook, and please go there. And anybody who wants to have you speak at a event, I think it would be wonderful and very, very inspiring. So I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, it's just fantastic what you're doing. This is what I've been, really why I started this program was to try to motivate people to preserve these memories, to keep the stories going, and not give up. It's like what you said, you have to start. It's one keystroke at a time.
Persevere.
For most people. Most people write it on a computer, by the way. But
I've learned.
But when you sit there and you're left-handed, right, and you write like me. And so to write it, I think that shows it's almost like Leo Tolstoy, you know. He when you think about it, he wrote, you know, his War and Peace is like 580,000 mm-hmm. words, and he wrote it all by hand. So look, even today, anybody out there, you don't have a computer, get started without the computer. Don't give up.
We'll help them.
That's
be
right.
Happy to.
And look at it as a labor of love, because it's so easy to walk away from that. You have to just keep
You have to love it. You do.
You do. And so thank you so much, Ray and Tricia Arredondo. I think what you're doing is fantastic, and I really appreciate you coming on the program today. And let me see. I have a few announcements. Last week, I had a wonderful author on. His name is Olivier Magny, and he wrote a wonderful book about Paris, stuff Parisians like. And he's also the founder of the best wine bar in Paris. And he sent me an email, and he invites all of my listeners to come to Paris and taste some wine at his wine bar. And so if anybody's going to Paris, make sure that you say bonjour from me, Patsy with a Z, and you'll get a free glass of wine and a wonderful, wonderful background into the wine business. And so do make a trip to Paris. This is Patsy with a Z, wishing you a great week. Go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com. And remember, as you've heard from the Arredondos, that one of the joys in life is to see your words on paper and to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Ah, that reminds me, your book would make a wonderful movie. So that's something we have to look forward to. So everybody out there, instead of just surfing the net or looking at the same old stuff, start doing some research and start writing your family history and preserve those memories. If you start now, you could have the makings of a great Christmas gift. Join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. Have a great week.